This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight's program features three Poets Laureate: Gwen O'Gara, who is Sonoma County's 6th Poet Laureate, Albert Flynn DeSilver, Marin County's 1st Poet Laureate, and Carol Muskie Dukes, who is our current California State Poet Laureate. Before I get to that part of the program, though, I want to mention that on Saturday night, February 6th, I attended Poetry Out Loud, a national recitation contest, and this was for the Sonoma County's High School Championship. Many high schools throughout the county attended this competition or took part in the competition. John Henry Bussey from Annalee High School all the way to Nolan Trude from Creekside High School. The winner of the competition will go on to compete at the statewide level in Sacramento. I want to take just a minute to congratulate the two winners from the other evening. Brooke McLaughlin is the runner-up, and if anything happens to the first-placed winner in this contest so that he cannot go on to Sacramento, she will fill those very important shoes. So congratulations, Brooke McLaughlin. The winner for the Sonoma County High School Championship for Poetry Out Loud is Giovanni Espinosa. Giovanni is a student at Piner High School, and he did a magnificent job. Congratulations to Giovanni. Okay, on with the show for this evening. The first Poet Laureate who is going to be reading is Albert Flynn DeSilver. DeSilver is Marin County's 1st Poet Laureate, and his Poet Laureate project includes the creation of, along with artist Todd Pickering, the Poetry Chair. It's an armchair that is actually made out of poetry books, and he takes this chair around with him all over the county to host readings and writing workshops. DeSilver's poetry collections include Letters to Early Street from La Alameda University of New Mexico Press and Walking Tooth and Cloud from French Connection Press. I have asked Albert to read some poems from both of those books. Here now is Albert Flynn DeSilver.
The Podium. The poet approaches the podium. Once there, he bows and grabs firmly each wooden edge like a bull by the horns. So much so that it becomes a bull's head and horns. No longer a mere simile, but the real thing. He is in Pamplona. The crowd shouts, Trompo delirio por las verdes ingles, horn of the lily through green groins. In the ring, he stumbles among crushed wax cups, hot dogs, and roses, addressing the frenzied crowd with his terror, his poems now woven into a single red cloth. He is chased viciously around the ring, tormented with imminent mockery, or even worse, the idea of his death. He is soon pinned against the far wall, face to face with the bull's nostrils, which are spewing forth ash from the incinerated bodies of small children. In an instant of blind fright, the man lunges and grabs the bull by the horns, like the square, ferocious edges of a podium, where he greets the audience with his first poem called The Podium. Clock on the Head. I wake up groggy and annoyed, hit the alarm clock with a handy bedside frying pan. The clock, upset, wrestles the handy pan from my hand and clocks me on the head. I fall back, fast asleep, deadpan beside the bed. The Tooth. The tooth is a hoof mistaken for a hat. The hoof in the mouth is a tongue full of wool. A woolen tongue does no good during feeding. The tooth is better for evening walks in the Forbes. The hat is lost to the words in the Forbes. The Forbes are a long time in waiting to be eaten with the words. The man with the woolen tongue and the hoof in his mouth is a long time waiting for Forbes, for words. Both starve in the meantime. The meantime gives neither a thought, and the world turns once again through the trembling, open mouth of the night. One Thumb Book. I am building a little book for my thumb, where we will shovel lint from the street's navel and juice lullabies from the treetops. It is a book of elastic steel married to song. an opposable piano picked up in Mozambique, each page a print, a maze of jagged feet clambering up the stairwell of your spine. This, a gnarled tornado as opposed to a combed one. This, a hairy coin of sorts, the flipping of which is the fondling of crude feathers, where we memorialize the world record holder in the pole vault. My plane. My plane is huge. It is transcontinental. It hugs the sphere way up high. When in flight, my plane averages 551 miles per hour at an altitude of 37,000 feet. This makes me nervous, makes me need a Valium the size of a hubcap to calm me down upon my plane. The pilot of my plane wears a leopard skin headdress and cranks Frank Sinatra on the Victrola over the intercom. The distortion is excruciating. The fuselage of my plane is made of deer meat hanging in the sun's arms. We are fed venison with our mixed nuts. My plane is very gamey. The steward eye on my plane are French homoerotic economists. They turn me on, then kindly turn me off for a small fee. My plane has one overhead compartment. It is named Sky. All my luggage fits in there. My plane has several emergency exits for my safety, both fore and aft. And just in case, I sit both fore and aft, looking forward to the emergency, wondering what I'll do afterwards. In the event of a water landing, I feel confident that I can be directed by a crew member to do the backstroke, butterfly, or doggy paddle. The miniature bottles of spring water are to be used as a flotation device. Upon liftoff of my plane, all of my nerves smolder before my very eyes in the seat pocket in front of me, fizzling out into the recirculated air. While in the lavatory, I experience turbulence and bang my head against the smoke detector. The steward eye on my plane accuse me of tampering. They smell the funny smoke of smoldering nerves upon my clothes, and instead of arresting me, force me out into the harsh crust of our cruising altitude. They lead me out blindfolded mid-flight to the end of our de-iced wing. There, they let me off somewhere above Assisi, freeing me from my plane and the ideas I have created about it. Letter 1. Dear Demian, this is not the first one or even the beginning. Early Street doesn't have a when. It doesn't begin, perhaps I shall practice being dead to the world. How dead to the world of sensation, thought, idea is? I am not my idea. So perhaps I shall practice being dead to the world, word, which is all idea, as one practices knitting, guitar, medicine, or poetry for that matter, an unattached ecstatic, rather affectionately yours. For Halloween, I am spirit dressed up as matter, dead to the world of sensation, lank, bristling, vacantly quenched. I discover letter one will not escape its singularity. The womb looms always in my yearning. This is the thought I'm not, and yet I write with craving, a watershed, a womb, a wreath of manzanita at my fingertips. There is ink in the wreath of manzanita, scrawling upon the clouds who blur up the sweat-drenched sun. Now just a pile of weepy ash, defining the wind, massed as you're thinking the womb. So every day I practice this knitting with flame, ice skate across eyeball, strum the double yellow lines strung across Early Street's dual-string asphalt guitar, nurtured by this absence of when, this song that reveals how it doesn't begin or end with being dead to sensation's wind. Letter 25. Dear mid-February dawn, it's morning in the headlands. In the sky, she said, in the sky where we were basted, in a little torn piece of it, sky, so swollen blue. I fell in love with and suffered an immaculate orange trough. An immaculate orange trough, the tankers are pasted against the horizon, like small cities drifting out to sea, where a cluster of my celebrated thoughts bob. Church bells on the choppy surface, war batteries wander, crumble off worn-out soils. A man takes a picture and is halved. The landscape suffers a minor misreading, eventually takes its picture back. Slam of waves through rock spouts, brushes air's knots out, like how all my exiting lovers leave me Neruda, nude and sputtering at the snowy moon. I have a hankering for women with a wind chill. Here's where I repeatedly swoon. I think of all the frivolous tremblings because of my, them, of. I've fallen in of with yet again. In the midst of this letter, is it 11? Letter 11 from the headlands? The one with asphalt ripples, this morning's rolling ocean skin? This is number 25. Numbers are chasms with hats. I want to cradle that frigid lava peeled from the Golden Gate and placed in my eye. It is smeared in a way, in a tasty way, to my eye's tongue, my tongue's eye, seeing apricot spreadable fruit, breakfast in the headlands. Good morning. Letter 54. Dear Demian, this is not the last one or even the beginning. Early Street doesn't have an end, or even a when. For all the pulpy tundra's teeth are agape with gaps. Snow drifts in between them teeth to the heated mouth. Where in the beginning it is found never ends, the end ever ending is all busied and bruised. I find me to be my own brazen druid acolyte, 1 minute picking blueberries in the schwangunks, the next spasmodically thriving off the absence of actuality. I'm equipped with more facades than a fake mining town. There is a fake mining town roaming around in my head right now. I feel I must change my bonnet mid-nod. Now I nod off often into exotic war zones. The wars in the paper are an erogenous zone. I am in love with all of the above. I am in love with the it of its raining. You, in the muggy midst, my nights of thin sleep, scant trains, midtown canyon thunderstorms. Each sheet between us is a blank star. Our love, it bleats in silver carbonated blots. I feel closer to you, my angelic blank star, as affectionately detached as a well-fed cat. Presence as condiment, my face against the window, feeding off the able blend of morning light on 49th Street. Robins and sparrows in the sumac trees between brick buildings, a two-call crow and a skill saw. I must be in the country, the city, the same elusive thing, here where my dying elders' embers are, my darlings. We, busy sponging the receding light, where the thoughts foam up and disperse at once, and I into a born-again invertebrate ink spot, a great floral stain on the pulpy tundra's teeth. I smile as only a hand can smile, with these letters in hand, in tooth, on my way to the post-box, the hat-box, the box of rain on the stoop, overflowing with the song of how it doesn't begin or end with being married to sensation's wind.
And if you just tuned in, that was Albert Flynn de Silver, Marin County's first poet laureate, reading from his two books, Walking Tooth and Cloud and Letters to Early Street. Up next, our sixth Sonoma County Poet Laureate, Gwen O'Gara. O'Gara is a teacher with California Poets in the Schools and is the author of three chapbooks of poetry, Winter at Green Haven, published by Small Change Series of the Word Temple Press, Fixer Upper, published by D Press, and Snake Woman Poems, published by Beatitude Press. Let's go now to an interview and reading with Gwen O'Gara. Well, welcome, Gwen O'Gara, our new Poet Laureate of Sonoma County. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you, Catherine. It's a pleasure to be here.
Are you excited?
I'm absolutely thrilled.
Yeah, good. So tell me a little bit about your history in Sonoma County as far as poetry is concerned and what led up to this wonderful nomination.
Good question. We moved up here to raise our son about 14 years ago, and there was most definitely a there here. There was a here here. And although I was busy with domestic matters, I, of course, continued to write, and I'd go to all the readings I could, and I'd go to Word Temple, the reading you series you hosted, and I started to connect with other poets, and I was working with California Poets in the Schools. And so through them, I got to know new poets, fellow poets, poet teachers. And I started the Redheads, and we performed together.
Oh, that's right, the Redheads.
Yes.
There are four of you.
There
correct?
Are Susan Kennedy, Phyllis Meshulam, and Penelope LaMontagne. And so I got to give some readings and go to readings. And one thing led to another. I was flabbergasted to be nominated, of course, and then to actually win. I didn't believe it when the news was to me.
Well, it's true.
It's true.
You're there.
I found that since.
How long did you teach in California poets in the schools, and are you still doing that now?
I still am. This is about my 20th year.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's dedication.
It's a lot of fun. There were some years I missed when our son was very young, but it seems I've made up for those years since.
Yeah. Well, I know that as a poet laureate, you have a project.
Yes.
And what is your project?
My project is to expand the conversation of poetry in Sonoma County. And yes, we have a lot of fine poets here, a great community. But I am hoping to extend the conversation to people who are still reticent, perhaps have never written a poem before. Seamus Heaney, in an interview last spring, said, poetry and the arts, if they do anything, they help to fortify your inner life. And our inner lives always need fortification, and particularly now. And poetry certainly has done that for me. And I hope through getting the word out in the next few years to collect poems and every quarter or so invite some unsung poets up on stage with me when I'm reading and ask them to read their poems too.
And how will you get the word out there? Who will you be? Which communities will you be inviting?
Well, I hope not only the literary community, but the public at large. And I hope to use newspapers, radio, and whatever else I can figure out.
Are you looking for different age groups and people, or?
I'd like to invite youth, children, youth, and adults.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Good, good.
Because I know there are more poems in people. Sometimes you just have to invite them.
Would you define what you mean by the inner life when you talk about this project?
I think the inner life comes out in our poetry. And what I found in my teaching is often my primary task is to either show or remind children and adults and teenagers that they have an inner life. And I mentioned this to a Zen Buddhist monk that I met at a party a few years ago, and he knew exactly what I meant, and he said, "Well, I know what you mean, and my task is not only to show them they have an inner life, but to help them value that inner life." So I mentioned these two thoughts to my yoga teacher, Ann Austin, and she said, "Oh, I know what you mean, and my task is not only to show people they have an inner life and to help them value it. My task is to show them that they can access at any time." And I love those three moments of illumination, of clarity about that our private world is important. Yes, it's sacred and it's private, but there are times that it's necessary to share that private world and your individual perspective, and to celebrate what you consider beautiful. A lot of children in classrooms, I don't think anybody's ever asked them, what is beautiful to you? And that's something we, as a culture, need to cultivate.
You mentioned before we started the interview that it was Mike Tuggle who called you to let you know that you are the new poet laureate. And of course, everyone knows that Mike was our past poet laureate for the last 2 years. And asking you about your project reminds me that he also had a project, and he was going to have a library created of Sonoma County poets' works. Do you know if that is in place yet?
I don't know, but that's a great question.
It probably is somewhere. We'll have to look into that. Okay, thanks. Yeah. Okay, well, let's turn the mics over to you now so you can read from some of your books. This is Gwen O'Gara.
My first poem is called "The Spirits That Lend Strength Are Invisible." The title is a Navajo saying, and I'm excited about this poem because it was published in the latest issue of Calix. The grandmothers came to me on the wind, the furious wind from the west. They came from the sun as I rocked and rocked beneath the sky of one color, pale as my baby's skin and as bright. I saw them and heard them as I rocked and rocked for dear life coming out of me, coming down slowly out of me, as I rocked back and forth and back and forth, as he pushed out of and back into me. The grandmothers came to me and whispered, breathe, rock, wait, open. They came with the wind out of the sun. They came from their cave, hidden in time, from their procession down to the sea, where they prepared me years before in dream. They came and brought strength and peace, so I could rock into the dusk and on into the darkness, rocking and breathing and fighting the peaceful way, to let my baby deliver himself to me from their cave that is endless and built of moons. I rocked and I rocked, and the grandmothers came to me and whispered their words of power to help me through the long disengagement of my son. On wheelchairs, corn stalks, mops, and meteorites, they traveled and turned through the white sky. They gathered around my head in whorls of cooling fire, and they gave me water from the sun that burned me cool, and they took from me my separateness. No longer, not ever, would I be sola. And they eased me open to let out my son. So I rocked forward to become a mother, and backward to join them, the ancient ones, holders of life, bringers of life. My next poem is called To an Ordinary Woman. It matters that you cope. Take the kids to practice, cook, and get to work without imploding and becoming a burden. Yet grief catches up with you. The missed appointments simply postponed. The safety pin on the floor appears incredibly sad, like the rasp of the night heron returning home at dawn. Tears, mess, mysteries about a brassy woman afraid of a hip replacement. You want to go down to the dark, die a little, perhaps join your companion. All day, the red-shouldered hawk cries out her longing, grief, and hunger. If poppies close at night, so can you, till dawn's noisy light. Mother's at Big Sur. She gave me the stone house with window lace of foam, close as I could live to the ocean and not freeze or drown. She taught me to love beauty, to put a good face on anger, and to wait. Young, I wanted more. Jade waves break against the mountain's feet. Turquoise wind stings tears into songs of grief. Before they go, monarchs, sun among silver leaves, lit candles in a war zone. Above the valley, an adobe crumbles. A young cat stares, wisps of fur in front of his ears. Electricity shoots between us. We are not kin. He shape changes into the brush. His long ring tail warns me not to follow. Willow, oak, and I sing the trail to the sea. Unseen on the ridge, Mother Bobcat watches. Slipping over bull kelp, I wade Big Sur River up to my waist. My smell changes. I circle through scrub to my car, stirring up dust that whispers in the glistening air and drifts on. For all of you who grew up in San Francisco, whether staring at the bay or the ocean or the hills, Pacific Heights. Outside the gate, whales echolocate. On the bay, bells fill in for sight. By the stone fort, bollards rust. Beep lived on Jackson Street. We glimpsed heaven on his trampoline. The springs, like sissy mothers, squeaked. Walking home through fog, the world a giant pearl. A luminous blindness guided us. Children and ghosts still roam this milky world. Musical sacks of sea, at home in the liminal, attached beyond reason to the holdfast coast. Winter at Greenhaven, and it's a series of short or shortish poems. Portals. For love or a fee, a popular poet will guide you to a hawk ledge on an island in the northern sea. A morning's hike from his friend's farm, the two worlds touch. The portal in, the portal out. The portal forward, the portal back. For the solitary, portals open anywhere. The hall to the sick room, the tussock in the field, your own sweet pillow of leaves and desire. The path to Bullfrog Pond climbs the ridge from the mossy floor. No wind disturbs Raven's woody words, and the sun makes promises it will keep all summer. And the sun makes promises it will keep all winter. Winter. Woolly clouds dream the world gray. A young man sits with a jug of water and a frisbee at his feet. His beloved stretches on the bench, sinking into it. They study the sunset as if it were the last. A man takes notes in a journal. His posture promises precision and intensity. At the dog park, mutts and retrievers play like there's no tomorrow. Instead of rose hips, a dry stream bed. Instead of joy, musing. Instead of excitement, a mushroom cap. The speckled orange cap dissolving into the background. Friend. The field is dry, the stream is still, but the door to the rabbit's body is open. Moon friend, invisible. Instead of Alaska, I enter the wilderness of you. Pages of Rumi. A midnight of a day. Abandoned ambitions and obligations. Rain, the sweet pound and puddle build, the way lit by lichen and prayer. Acorns, let him heal. Let there be a seed in me and a tree. Let birds nest in me. Let moss drip from my back. I kept today like the Sabbath. When I vacuumed, my chest hurt. December. Hey, Pleiades, old friends, come to help me winter through? When the field is dry, when we need to walk beyond thought, when the rabbit's foot still connects to the shin. Rain shoulders the night, same old, new green flood song.
You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. This is Catherine Hastings. You just heard Sonoma County's current 6th Poet Laureate, Gwen O'Gara, reading from her work. Up next, Carol Muskie Dukes, the California State Poet Laureate, will give a reading. But first, let's have a musical interlude. This is Zha La La singing the best version I've ever heard of Johnny Mercer's Accentuate the Positive.
Topic will be sin, that's why I'm again. If you wanna hear my story, then settle back and just sit tight while I start reviewing the attitude of
You're listening to Word Temple. This is Catherine Hastings. Always a little ahead of the pack, California was the first state to appoint a poet laureate when Ina Donna Coolbrith was chosen by Governor Hiram Warren Johnson and appointed on June 30, 1915. The position at that time was referred to as the Loved Laurel-Crowned Poet of California and was conferred for life. Ina Donna Coolbrith held the position until her death in 1928. In 2001, Governor Gray Davis signed a bill that established the position of California Poet Laureate, a two-year position that is confirmed by the Senate from a list of three nominees provided by the Arts Council. California, of course, has no shortage of really fine community-involved poets. Carol Muskie Dukes is our latest State Poet Laureate of California. She's the author of 8 books of poetry, most recently Sparrow, a National Book Award finalist, published by Random House. One of the 8, Twin Cities, will be coming out from Viking Penguin in early 2011. Her 4 novels are Life After Death, Random House, Saving St. Germ, Penguin, Dear Digby, Viking, and her most recent, Channeling Mark Twain, also from Random House. She is the author of a collection of essays entitled Married to the Ice Pick Killer, A Poet in Hollywood, and a collection of reviews and critical essays, Women and Poetry, Truth, Autobiography, and the Shape of the Self. She is a regular critic for the New York Times Book Review and the Los Angeles Times Book Review. Her work appears everywhere from the New Yorker to L.A. Magazine, and she has anthologized widely, including in Best American Poems, 100 Great Poems by Women, and others. Muskie Dukes is professor of English and creative writing and founding director of the new Ph.D. program in literature and creative writing at the University of Southern California. She has received many awards and honors, including a Guggenheim Fellowship, a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, an Ingram Merrill, the Witter Binner Award from the Library of Congress, the Castagnoli Award from the Poetry Society of America, and several Pushcart Prizes. Carol Muskie Dukes was the last reader for the Word Temple Poetry Series in 2009 and was kind enough to record some poems and to talk about her project as California State Poet Laureate. Let's go now to Carol Muskie Dukes.
It's actually called the Magic Poetry Bus, and it's a, I don't know what to call it exactly. It's a project that I'm charged to do by the governor's office. When one is made Poet Laureate in California or Poet Laureate of California, one is asked to not only give 6 readings during the two-year term of the poet laureateship, but also to create a or develop a statewide poetry project, which will reach communities throughout California. I thought a little bit about the kinds of things that I could do in this regard. I've worked with, I'm a professor at the University of Southern California, so I do a lot of teaching, both undergraduate and graduate, but I have had experience as well teaching in the prisons, in New York City, Rikers Island, and throughout the state of New York and elsewhere, also working in juvenile facilities and with women in many different situations. So I thought it might be useful to do something more alternative and try to create something that would reach communities everywhere, not only in terms of individual readings, but in something that would be more, create something that would be more permanent. So I came up with an idea called the Magic Poetry Bus. And my idea with the Magic Poetry Bus, and we now have a website, which is magicpoetrybus.org, is to have a sort of interact virtual bus. That is to say, we will have poets traveling around to different communities and reading to kids in schools mainly, elementary and high school, and teaching. But we are also merged now with a program called Get Lit, which is a teen literacy project coming out of Los Angeles. And the most amazing thing that they do with Get Lit, which I'm a big fan of, is that they read poetry and they memorize it. They read and memorize canonical poetry, and then they recite it in performance and segue into their own spoken word. It is absolutely riveting. the fact that they're working throughout the public schools in Los Angeles and elsewhere. I brought them to the New York Bowery Poetry Club recently, and I'm going to introduce them in other venues. And we're working together. We now have clips of them using what they do as a teaching technique. I also came up with an idea called proactive poetry that Get Lit and I are, these teen poets and I are working on. And what I did was ask friends who are poets, Robert Pinsky, Jory Graham, Joy Harjo, just to name a few, who more or less donated or gave us the rights to an individual poem to be used as a conversation poem. This is where the proactive part comes in. Pinsky's The Shirt, for example, we break it apart. After like three stanzas, there's a response from the individual teenage or classroom poets or child poets and student poets, and then back to the Pinsky poem, back to the response, and so on. So that what is happening, in effect, is teaching the poem, memorizing and teaching the poem, and adding one's own original response. So it's a kind of learning poem through conversation. You're talking to the poem. I'm very proud of this technique that we came up with, Get Lit and I. The Magic Poetry Bus will also, so we'll have all this online. We have on our website, we will be putting up all of these different clips of these poems being learned and recited and responded to. And also I'm creating a guide, a sort of Magic Poetry Bus driver's guide, which will be a handbook to learning, teaching and learning poetry, which will be available for everyone in California, teachers and students. I'm planning to work a little bit with a wonderful poet, Cecilia Wallach, who is doing remarkable work in the schools around USC, where we both teach, and has a website as well, and a workbook. So much to be planned with this. I'm very proud of this project, and I'm hoping that it will affect almost every, well, that's a little too grand, but maybe it will reach a number of schools and alternative communities in California. I'd like to read a little bit from Sparrow, which is my most recent book of poems, a book which came out in 2003 and is pretty much entirely made up of elegies for my late husband, David Coleman Dukes, who was a wonderful actor. And the poems are meant to be meditations, in large part on both acting and poetry and where those arts come together. A number of the poems have partial titles from plays or films. And I might read one actually, this is a poem that was in the New Yorker a while back. And it's actually written from the point of view of someone who's trying to meditate on grief and how to move away from grief. One of the things that I did after David died was to look at his screenplays and play scripts and teleplays and try to come up with dialogue that would sort of get me out of the high rhetoric of grief. So this poem plays with the idea of different rhetorics. And so there are quotes from actual screenplays. And there's a Neil Simon play in there somewhere. And the play Art, which he was in London, comes in briefly. They're just little notes, little parts of the dialogue. So it's called A Private Matter. And here it is. A private matter. You, never you, the new vessel. Dark light of the sprung soul. Flung upward or shuttered. Upringing, iridescent as a fountain, eyes flickering wide open in sleep, and on the kitchen sideboard, backs of script pages cut up by you to memo size. If someone jots a note, turns it over, there are words, dialogue of people you once became or not. Laura says she cannot command the space station alone any longer. Can't he see this? Brent says he knows. He knows what she has been going through. I don't know what these words are for, just as I know you will arrive no more to counter this argument. You may have said these things aloud. You walked, you lay once beside me. Albert says suddenly from a paper, vague, cryptic, enigmatic, ambiguous. Claude says, how do you mean? I want to enter every semblance of you. Profile, ideogram, rain light, zigzag kite, shifting plinth, even this comment from Mohammed. I should be going. This is a private matter. Earlier, Frida has said, "You're upsetting me, Ira." Let me consider this private matter in anger, in terror, in reverence. Voiceless, let me consider a thumbprint, a top sheet, margin shout. Here's Mark crying, "Bullshit. How can a man live in any other time but his own?" At the tombstone, the fire pit, at the anchor dragged, brain red over consciousness, Ivan says, "I don't see why I have to put up with your tantrums." In this private matter, I refuse the lilac, the anemone, all the lit, banked candles. Rachel says, "He's in the middle of nowhere, without an alibi." Bring me no alibi, bring me instead one sprig, pale white of your never endlessness, one pulse leap inside the sick, brilliant rose of your not being. Holden says, "That's my girl. Fire rose, ash drawn petaled, unpetaled along my wall of solitude. You hover eyelid at falcon height, and Serge cries, "Read Seneca." Laura is alone in the space station, weeping. I am not weeping. I am emptying the pockets of my own monologues. I am listening to the semblances, what you were, who you've been. "You're disastrously open-minded," a fragment says. It seems to me, though I ask for no feedback here in my space station, here in my former life, where there is no gravity, or this crushing gravity, in my kitchen, my open mind, where I listen closely to no connections, to you, David, know you. This next poem is a short poem about a kind of elegy called Passport, a Manifesto. "This is your passport I hold in my hand, a hemisphere, half red ink, half blue, as yet untorched by terror, but polluted perhaps by the gaze of the future. For example, the shadow of the parachute of my desire, this ripcord rip of your photo blink, your eyes translated into these flashing, sad idioms. Take this blank page for the remainder, the last boring national tattoos. Wave me through these invisible brackets of lightning. Stars shatter on the epaulets of all the uniforms, the hats and coats of countries that no longer exist. I wear your insignia, therefore I wear death's insignia, which means that nothing can hurt me. And with these wings and flames, I pledge allegiance to nothing. I can go anywhere." My late husband was born in San Francisco and grew up in Marin County. And then we I met him in Italy, oddly, because I was at San Francisco State myself. I lived in San Francisco for as a graduate student for some time. But we met much later in life. And then I was in New York, he was in LA, and we ended up going back and forth for a while. And then living in LA, but also returning to New York, where he did Broadway and I also worked. But, you know, it was a back and forth kind of amazing traveling life. And here's a poem called Love Song, sort of about that time, our marriage. "Love comes hungry to anyone's hand. I found the newborn sparrow next to the tumbled nest on the grass, bravely opening its beak. Cats circled, squirrels. I tried to set the nest right, but the wild birds had fled. The knot of pin feathers sat in my hand and spoke. Just because I've raised it by touch doesn't mean it follows. All day it pecks at the tin image of a faceless bird, refuses to fly, though I've opened the door. What sends us to each other? He and I had a blue landscape, a village street, some poems, bread on a plate. Love was a camera in a doorway. Love was a script, a tin bird. Love was faceless, even when we'd memorized each other's lines. Love was hungry, love was faceless. The sparrow sings famished in my hand." And one more from Sparrow. This is called Waiting For, and of course, the missing word, since many of these poems have the titles of plays. Waiting For, duh. Godot. David was in that play several times, and there's a couple of lines from the play. "Was I sleeping while the others suffered? You asked because you were Vladimir. and it was your turn to speak, to cry out, astride the grave, a difficult birth. Then I was terrified of you and your transient heart, your hat pulled down to your eyes, bewhiskered, old, but your gaze young, demented, blue. It occurred to me that we'd never come to a crossroads, or we'd always come to a crossroads. The two tramps were waiting, but we had never waited for each other. Habit is a great deadener, Vladimir said, but we never lived with habit. You sat up in bed, as I philosophized, your face alight. Leaves fell upward. We laughed weightless, pulled down by gravity. Each day was unlike the others. For years at a time, remember, or not, nothing in our lives was ever usual. I'm going to read a few poems. I should mention that David trained at ACT here or in San Francisco, and before he went to Broadway as a young actor, and his first play was Molière, actually on Broadway. They don't do Molière any longer, but he did Molière and then did was Henry Carr and Tom Stoppard's Travesties. But I think I will read just one more poem from Sparrow, which is about David and Molière, called The Empty Chair. Your resemblance to Molière, there it was in the cameo from your School for Wives days, the same feral, weighted gaze and erotic mouth, playing out a small struggle between flesh and spirit, one in your face, by the will to please. You could make your smile conventional, but charm, rigorous charm, how far can it take one, and the dangerous power of impersonation? Actors give up their bodies to it, their souls. Yeats quoted the Indian mystic who said, if a man died playing Hamlet, he would be Hamlet after his death. If I ascend on my last breath to that bright stage, then behold you, ignorant of my face or any other, not in a mask, could I bear to love only a resemblance? All is resemblance within the swirling, differing capacities. Molière on stage, feigning death, then dying his own, his chair left empty, like yours, here, black canvas, director style. Your name on the back writ in the uncanny light that falls on what I've written, each simple-minded coincidence. Then those darker flashes of a larger portrait, the lineaments of a criminal or deity, the argument of each made-up gaze, Molière's likeness, or wait, yours, your face. I'd like to read some poems from my new book of poetry called Twin Cities, which will be out from Penguin, I think, late 2010, early 2011. I'll just read a couple poems from this manuscript, Twin Cities. Twin Cities comes from, obviously, the idea of the Twin Cities. I was born in St. Paul, and grew up in St. Paul, Minneapolis, in Minnesota. And the idea of twins has always captured my imagination, the idea of the two. So many of the poems in this book are centered on the notion of the double or two or the twin. There are a couple of title poems, Twin Cities 1, 2, 3. I don't know which one this is, but this one was in the New Yorker recently called Twin Cities. I guess it's Twin Cities 1. It was the river that made them two, the mills on one side, the cathedral on the other. We watched its swift currents. If we stared long enough, maybe it would stop cold and let us skate across to the other side. But it never froze in place, though I once knew a kid, a wild, funny girl, who built a raft from branches, which promptly sank a few feet out from the elbow bend off Dayton's Bluff, who made it seem easy to believe. We'd tried to break into Carver's Cave, where once bootleggers hid their hot stash years after the Dakota drew their snakes and bears on the rock walls and canoed inside the caverns. We knew there were other openings in the cliffs, mirroring those same rock faces on the other side, and below them the caves, the subterranean pathways underlying the talk and commerce, the big-shot churches, undermining the false maidenliness of the convent school from which my friend was eventually expelled, for being too smart and standing up for her own smartness. Too late, I salute you, Katie McNally. I think that the river returned then to two-sidedness, an overhung history of bottle flash and hopelessness. I see you still, laughing as the lashed sticks sank beneath you, laughing as you did that morning when the river lifted its spring shoulders, shrugging off the winter ice, that thin, brittle mirage, making you believe we were all in this together. Two coasts. I own them both. Sometimes I wake up in somebody else's night, somebody else's day. I enjoy entering the lives of no one I know. You learn to live in transit, feel like a safety on a gun. I've been on the run since he stopped drawing breath. You want to be with me? Boarding pass is my answer. So every democracy of one's life has a little tyrant time, perpetual motion within my own shadow, away from me. I pledge allegiance to it. Beauty, beauty. Skyscraper caverns, the gold riprap of heels on pavement, silver Chrysler headdress, jeweled fan of Korean fruits. Times dropped like a baby on the tracks. Once underground in the sky, then desert by the sea, backlot, blue jacaranda boulevards, a house afloat on earth, many houses rippling like the screen coming down in the screening room of someone I call pal. Oh, my pal is a vampire, sky high on Sunset Boulevard showing his choppers. Come to me, bloodlust, better yet, good coffee on either side of the country. Blue ambassador, I believe in myself, like a law book studied in solitary. I want to be in as much as I want out. This is a poem. This is a poem about Los Angeles, but also about death, I think, inescapably, called Condolence Note, Los Angeles. I actually saw a couple of, I was sitting by a pool in Los Angeles and saw there was no one there except me and two teenage kids who were sort of conferring on how to write a condolence note. It was very funny in a sort of grim way. They had a guide, a sort of Emily Post manners guide to how to write this kind of note after someone has died. Condolence Note, Los Angeles. The sky is desert blue, like the pool, secluded. No swimmers here, no smog, unless you count this twisting brush fire in the hills. Two kids sit head to head poolside, rehearsing a condolence note. Someone has died. Not an intimate, perhaps a family friend, prompts the manners guide they consult. You shouldn't say God never makes mistakes, she quotes, snapping her bikini top. Right, he adds, you could say he's better off. Or heaven was always in his future. There's always been a better way to say, we're sorry that he's dead. But they're back inside their music now, pages of politeness fallen between them. Oh, do not say that the unsaid drifts over us like blown smoke. A single spark erupts in wildfire. Cup your hands, blow out this wish for insight. Say, forgive me for living when you are dead. Say, pardon my need to praise. Without you, this bright morning sky. It belongs to no one, but I offer it to you, heaven in your future, along with silent tunes from the playlist, the end time etiquette book, dropped from the hand of the young sleeper. It's all we have left to share, the book of paid respects, the morning's hot blue iPod, sunlit words on a page, black border.
This is Catherine Hastings. You just heard California Poet Laureate Carol Muskie Dukes reading from her work. Before that, Gwen O'Gara, Sonoma County's 6th Poet Laureate, and Albert Flynn DeSilver, Marin County's 1st Poet Laureate. Be sure to tune in next month to Word Temple. My guests will be Lord Gawain Douglas, who is the great-nephew of Lord Alfred Douglas, a poet and Oscar Wilde's lover, and also Cecilia Wallach, who is the author of many, many books of poems, including her latest, Carpathia, published by BOA Editions. If you have any comments or questions about tonight's show, I'd love to hear from you. You can write to me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.